There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave counsel. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1207 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile, new week to work with. It's good. Phone and text hotline 343-0106. As I start off here, too, somebody throwing this at me. Okay, this is wasn't going to talk about it, but I'm going to defend myself. Somebody said, well, the Oprah thing, yeah, you didn't care, but 17 million viewers watched that thing. Okay, fine. Okay, no, 17.1 million. Here's a link they sent me from Showbiz 411. Yeah, let's get the info. Oprah's Royal Special got 17.1 million people, whopping big number, 10 million more than CBS usually gets in that hour. Okay. I got an idea how they could have gotten bigger numbers. Just, we got a whole bunch of show to get into and line out what we're doing today. But, and Leanna, if you agree or disagree on this, but if you would have gotten the Queen or other royal, I don't know all their names, I'm sorry, I don't... They don't concern me very much. But if you got them off stage, kind of like a, they still do Maury Povich, is that, I don't even know the dang daytime TV show, but like a Maury, like one of those shows, right? And then like Markle, Meghan could say something about the Queen or something, and then she comes running in from off, like from off stage, and then they're screaming, like a fight breaks out there, and the faux security has to come in and break them up, and that, and Oprah's up there, no, don't do that. They're like throwing chairs or something. Like that would have gotten 27 million viewers. Just saying, if they would have had the statements made and then be like, well, guess who's here, and here comes the Queen, and then she goes nuts and it's just like hitting her with a handbag or something like that. Now, there would be entertainment. I probably would have probably watched some of that. All right, just an idea. So the people are throwing it, you know, the overnight TV numbers on that. I'm just pointing out what could have brought even more numbers in would have been kind of like a Jerry Springer interpretation of the interview going on there. So, Oprah, I mean, you're good at your job, but you could have been just a little bit better. All right. Also, it's okay to see grandparents now in person. Here, the latest, you might have heard an update there from our national news. It says, let's see, and this is coming from News Nation Now from WKRG.com. Fully vaccinated Americans can gather with other vaccinated people indoors without wearing a mask or social distancing, according to the long-awaited guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Recommendations released today also say that vaccinated people can come together in the same way in a single household with people considered at low risk for severe diseases, such as a case of vaccinated grandparents visiting healthy grandchildren and children. So there you go. Goes on to say, officials say a person is considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after receiving the last required dose of the vaccine. CDC is continuing to recommend that fully vaccinated people continue to wear well-fitted masks, avoid large gatherings, and physically distance themselves from others when out in public. CDC also advised that vaccinated people get tested if they develop symptoms that could be related to COVID-19. How about that? So there you go. So yeah, the new guidance today. So new guidance today, you can have the Easter egg hunt. You know, next month you can have the Easter egg hunt, at least if nothing changes between now and then. They said if you have small family gatherings, everybody's been vaccinated, then you can be together with small groups of people. So take that for what it is. All right, coming up today, hour number two, Dr. Daniel Sutter from Troy University is going to join us. He is a professor of economics there and wrote a piece over at Yellowhammer I thought was very interesting, breaking down the kind of the what if and what if not when it comes to stimulus measures. His story, have Washington's stimulus measures saved our economy? We'll talk about that with him coming up at 1 o'clock. Plus, Lori Knight, who is the beautiful bride of my buddy Bryant Knight with Team Fight or Die, is going to join us to talk about a program out here for a scholarship, actually scholarships, plural, available for folks that are either veterans or people working on veterans issues. She'll break it down there and how you can apply if you fit one of those categories. And it's, a $2,000 scholarship for college out there. So we'll talk about that coming up as well. So that's all coming up in the second hour. This hour, Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com, joins me. Lots to talk about, of course, in Montgomery. Also, we'll talk a little bit of Washington, but getting ready for another week up on Goat Hill. You heard it this morning. You heard it during Jeff show. It's time for round two or round three for Senator Del Marsh's gaming bill in the Senate. Does it get traction this week, and where does it go from there? We'll talk about that, plus state budgets in the mix, and what happened with that bill that would let the legislature call itself back into session. That and a whole lot more coming up with Todd in just minutes. All right, 1212 FM Talk 106.5, fast news break, and then we'll be right back. It's Midday Mobile, streaming live at FMTalk1065.com. Glad you're here.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
So welcome back, Midday Mobile, FM Talk 106.5. Joe Saylor with my buddy Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com. Hey, Todd.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going good. So much to talk about. I want to talk about, first of all, reminding folks if they want to get just an update on their day before they even get started, whether it's national politics or state politics. How do they find your website? How do they get signed up?
Oh, it's really easy. It's just aldailynews.com. That's the homepage. You're going to want to get the email, though, because that's how more and more people every day are getting the news they need to know to start their day. That's just click the newsletter link at the very top, enter your name and your email, and you'll be on the list. It's free, and we'd love to have you.
One of the stories in the email this morning, with virus aid in sight, Democrats debate filibuster changes. And I want to get into the debate around the actual issues. But before that, people talk about filibuster. It comes up and then it goes away and then the discussion comes back up. Filibuster is a what? What is a filibuster?
Well, essentially it is in the Senate rules, the longstanding Senate rules, any senator can stand up. And as long as they remain talking and hold the floor, they can delay a bill from being voted on or procedure from moving forward. And it takes 60 votes to shut down debate, right? If you've got senators who are kind of passing it around, passing debate around and dragging out debate, it takes 60 votes to say, okay, we're going to cut off this debate and move forward on this bill. There are certain circumstances where 60 votes aren't required. They just did this through the reconciliation process, which is a special rule reserved for budget-related items. I think they have kind of opened it up a little bit too broadly in recent years. But for most bills, including appropriations bills, including all the big stuff, you remember Obamacare, that took 60 votes. It takes 60 votes to cut off debate. And then move forward on something. So
even though the vote would be simple majority, the vote to cut off debate is a three-fifths.
Right. So it's really a procedure. And because it's procedural, you can kind of get away with things, right? You don't have to, let's say that you don't really want to say you voted against something. Well, technically you didn't. You just voted not to proceed, right? Or you voted not to allow the bill to proceed. So, and some people think it's an arcane, outdated thing, but, a lot of old school Senate folks say, no, it's needed. It is supposed to be hard to pass a bill. It's supposed to be hard to, get to the point where you can pass legislation. So, it's kind of the one last procedural hurdle they have in Congress to keep just almost anything from becoming law.
It gives strength to whatever party's in the minority.
It does. Right. And you know, Mitch McConnell, as minority leader, both now and during the Obama years, has wielded it very well. And, you know, it's not like it happens every single time. Surely, I mean, certainly, especially for appropriations bills and just things that have a lot of support, it's not a problem. But for votes like, you know, the one we just saw on the COVID relief bill, if you want to call it that, it never would have gotten close to 60 votes. I mean, they barely got 50. So, you know, that just goes to show you the kind of situation that is in Washington. And they may try to take action to change it. I don't think it'll be wholesale removal of the filibuster. But remember, they did remove it by rule. They did remove it for, you know, district and circuit judges, right? These judges that they would vote on. And that was back when Harry Reid ran the Senate. And Mitch McConnell said, mm-hmm. You're going to regret this. You're going to regret ending the filibuster for these judicial nominations. And he was right, because when Republicans got back the presidency with Donald Trump, they just filled the judiciary with conservative judges, and the Senate couldn't do anything about it. So you always got to be careful. Things like that, like ending the filibuster, they might sound good while you're in power, but the minute you're not, you're going to get steamrolled. So there's always a, you know, consequence.
So let's talk about its application here. And yes, with the COVID relief bill, which is kind of like calling the band Blondie a rap group, because they had that song Rapture and not a rock group. But yes, there was one time that they were rapping. So Joe Manchin steps up. Senator Joe Manchin steps up and give me what you think his motivation is for talking about, let's protect the right. I want Republicans involved, even though Republicans were not involved in this.
Well, look, I mean, Manchin is the quintessential swing vote, right? And he's really been playing an outsized role in the Senate over, you know, since Democrats took charge, because they know that they need his vote. You know, he knows that they need his vote, and so he'll get whatever he wants. And so I think, and to get reelected, to keep getting reelected, he's got to seem very bipartisan. West Virginia had one of the highest vote totals for Donald Trump, and yet, or vote percentages, and yet they elect a Democrat, you know, senator every 6 years. So it's pretty confusing, but to have that kind of, you know, you know, appeal over the party line there, he's got to, you know, at least be perceived as if he's working with Republicans. So that's what I think.
Which actually gives him, yeah, like you said, a lot of power, not being a sure thing for the Democrats. All right. So with this, I mean, you look at the stories that 9% or 10% of this $1.9 trillion goes to COVID. The 90-something percent goes elsewhere. How are they squaring this? I mean, there's got to be Democrats even that would, I would think, not elected officials, but maybe people who vote Democrat go, come on, y'all, this is not a COVID relief bill. It's a little bit of COVID in with another big spending bill.
Oh, yeah. And Manchin's one of them. And they took the unemployment down from 400 to 300. I mean, they really scaled back some of the stuff just because Joe Manchin said he wanted to. So he gets to go home and say, look, I made it the best bill I possibly can. Of course, it was not even close to anything Republicans would support. I mean, it's kind of out of the beholder, right? What is COVID relief? Is it just spending on health care and, you know, prevention and vaccines? Or is it, you know, bailouts for companies or for, you know, certain industries? You know, it depends what you mean. They can sell it as, yeah, look, we needed to give state and local governments $354 billion because they've been struggling in this pandemic. Well,
they were struggling before the pandemic.
Well, I mean, I can only speak for Alabama. I don't know what other states are in budget-wise, but we're doing fine. We thought there was going to be a big problem with the economy and how it affected the budgets, but it really hasn't. And so, you know, Alabama, the state of Alabama, is probably going to get about $4 billion out of this deal. I'm kind of wondering how we're going to spend it. I mean, maybe we do need that new state house after all. We've got to spend it somewhere.
okay, so this goes through. So right now we're just looking for a couple of amendments. But yeah, this is a done deal, right? I mean, it makes it onto President Biden's desk and gets signed here by tomorrow.
Yeah, but I don't even think they're going to be amendments.
Nothing more.
They don't want to come back to the Senate. There are some more progressive, more liberal folks in the House that are disappointed by several of the changes, but they're going to have to eat them because they do not want to go back to the Senate with more changes. It just complicates things. So, yeah, I expect this thing will be on Biden's desk by tomorrow night.
All right. Let's talk about this. We talk about the COVID portion of this here at home in Alabama. End of last week, we got the word from Governor Ivey that, all right, it's whatever, 35 days, I forget the math, until April 9th. We're still in a mask mandate, but at that point, it's gone. And it seems weird to me, Tom, that we were told all this time it was based on, you know, number of cases or new cases or hospitalizations. Now it's given a date that doesn't say anything about that. It just says as of April 9th, it'll be done.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody's been anticipating when this thing was going to end. By this thing, I mean the mask mandate. I think that's the one part of the health order that has been, I don't know, more broadly understood and you know, really got to frustrating people. But I was talking about this on Friday, or on Thursday, I guess, when she made that decision. And it struck me that, you know, it didn't lead the news, but it was included there. We wrote about it a little bit. That part of what she was doing was allowing businesses more time to prepare, mm-hmm. especially the retail, you know, the grocery stores. And I was thinking about it, you know, imagine if on Saturday,
yeah.
when the order ends, everybody just shows up to Publix, you know, without masks, they have a different policy, and it could really create a lot of headaches, to say nothing of drugstores and other retail stores. So it gives businesses a month to prepare and figure out what their policies are going to be, how they're going to deal with all this. And I kept hearing from the retail industry, wow, thank you, we needed that time. But it also gives, I think, the state overall just this light at the end of the tunnel. Like, it's coming, right? All you got to do is walk around outside, or even, you know, in some stores, and people are starting to get tired of it. They're starting to ditch the masks. But it gives everybody kind of a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, that, hey, this thing is coming to an end finally.
That's okay. And it's a good point to talk about where the retailers are. And that was one of the things early on that having a state mask mandate made it easier. You know, they said it was a guidance, I think, at first, right, that stores do this, even though they'd shut down all their mom and pops. But the big box stores should have this. But then they were getting blowback. And I can't imagine being a frontline person in a retail store telling somebody they have to put a mask on because that's store policy, and then they're screaming at you. They put this in, so it gave some extra teeth to that, or they could say, hey, I'm just complying. So now, if they keep the mask, they got a problem again, right? I respect their rights to do that as a private business, but then there's gonna be politics involved.
Yeah, and that's why they probably need some time to figure out, all right, if you're a national chain that works here, I'm sure these national chains like a Target or a Walgreens or what have you, I'm sure they have national policies, and perhaps it gives them time, because this is changing in states all over the country, and it's going to be eventually a patchwork of different policies. So yeah, what is their policy? What's it going to be? Do we respectfully request masks? Do we reach it all together? You know, what's it going to be? So I don't know what the answer to that is, but at least they have a little bit of time to figure that out before everybody just starts to, you know, it comes in all at once, and it'd be a little chaotic.
Yeah, coming back more with Todd Stacey from Alabama Daily News. Maybe we'll get him to give us his bet on whether Alabama will have a gambling bill come through the Senate and the House, signed off on by the governor, before the mask mandate ends early next month. We'll ask that and some other questions when we come back right here on Midday Mobile. This is FM Talk 106.5 and FMTalk1065.com.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, so welcome back, FM Talk 106.5. Midday Mobile, talking with my buddy Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com. Yeah, we went to the break. I said I would force Todd into making a bet. Which one happens first? Alabama passes a gambling bill or the mask mandate is lifted? Todd, and your money goes where?
April 9th.
Yeah,
it?
By April 9th.
Now, look, I tend to think if they have any chance of passing gambling, they're going to need to do it in the next couple of weeks. And so I'd say probably a gambling bill before, but that's not a very good bet.
That's why I'm setting it up that way, so I make the money. That's so house always wins. All right, so yeah, this week in Montgomery, so what house looking at budgets, or did they pass? Where are we on budgets?
So yeah, the house is going to take up the general fund. They got it through committee last week, and this is the kind of the boring stuff about state government, but really important. It's pretty much level funded. There are some plus ups from last year, but they're not dramatic. Every agency is getting a little bit more, but it's not, you know, some kind of windfall. The one great thing that happened in this year's budget is we don't have to spend as much on Medicaid because our federal matches a lot more. But so the House has taken up the general fund budget. In the Senate, they're gonna start on the gambling bill. So remember, it's been 2 weeks since they have debated it on the floor. Del Marsh is going to have a new proposal, which we still don't know exactly what's in that. He wanted to open it up to a few more casino locations, but we haven't seen the text yet, so we don't know. I tend to think he's got the votes in the Senate pretty well locked up. I mean, you're going to have plenty of senators that are going to vote against it on for different reasons, whether it's, you know, I don't like gambling or they don't like the way the bill's put together. But at the end of the day, I think he's going to have enough votes. Then it, you know, it'll go to the House. The thing there is timing. When do they bring it up in committee? Who's going to sponsor it in the House? Who's going to kind of carry the bill? And does it make it to the House floor without any kind of poison pill amendments that kill it? Look, I mean, there are so many people that are pessimistic about its chances in the House. I kind of am not. I think it has a pretty good chance because if you go back and look at the last time they debated gambling, it was the lottery bill. And the only reason it failed the procedural vote is because Democrats largely weren't supporting it because they didn't have the casinos. They didn't have all these things that the Democrats wanted in the bill. What? All that's in the bill now. So if you pick up, you know, 20, 25 Democrats, I think that's more than enough to get it over the finish line of the House. I think that's what nobody's really kind of talking about.
This idea of how many casinos, right, that may come back and go up by 5-7 casinos. I mean, this is sausage making, y'all. This is right. I mean, this is watching. Okay, these people want their part of the action if they're going to vote for it.
Yeah, and I mean, so right now, or at least what Dell described the bill as, would be 10 casinos. And that's the existing three that the Porch Creeks have in Atmore, Wetumpka, and Montgomery. Another one of those 10 would also be one of their properties up in North Alabama. And then the rest, you've got these existing dog track casinos. Now maybe one gets opened up to some kind of new bid or something. But I mean, look, it's been this way all along. The existing folks are going to have the casinos. They're going to be running them, and that's what they've negotiated, and that's what Dell's bill does. Maybe you'll see some amendments to change that, but I don't see the sponsor himself entertaining any other kind of plan because that's the agreement they've come to.
And this idea of separately filed bills, this idea of actually opening it up for, you know, competition and letting the counties make their decision and having other players in it, I've heard you talk about it, I've heard Jeff talk about it, that there's just, there's no way something like that passes.
Yeah, and I've heard people, I was reading stuff over the weekend, folks saying, well, let's just start all over. Let's, you know, get rid of everything and start all over. It's like, well, That sounds good, and from a purely public policy standpoint, yeah, of course you'd want to do that. But the whole reason we're having this conversation is because the Porch Creeks operate three casinos that, you know, the state has no ability to even regulate or shut down or anything. And then these dog track casinos have been allowed to, you know, exist and operate in various legalities. And so they're not going anywhere unless somebody passes a law and agrees to regulate them. And so that's where we are. And the other thing is they have so much influence over the legislature as it is now. They're not going to let a brand new, the Porch Creeks, for example, they're not going to voluntarily say, okay, we're just going to go away and let everybody, write us off into the law. And that's not going to happen. So I think what Senator Marsh has done is made about the best he can out of a patchwork of law, uneven enforcement maybe is the biggest problem, and just a situation that, yeah, it's a little weird and maybe not ideal, but, you know, maybe they're trying to go from the wild, wild west of unregulated casinos to something that is a professional regulated thing that actually does limit it in scope.
Yeah, but also picks winners.
Well, no question. I guess the my response to that would be that the winners have already been chosen, and there's not going. You know, I think it's acknowledging a reality that's there, and if they didn't go and do this, it wouldn't stop anybody from operating, unless, you know, maybe the Attorney General just started cracking down on these dog tracks. But again, this does nothing for the Porch Creeks. And we continue not to get any money out of it, any revenue out of it. So, if you're going to do something, this is about. It's going to be hard for any bill in the legislature to get through without support from both the Porch Creeks and the dog tracks. They have that on this bill, and so we'll see. We'll see if it's enough.
I just want people to hear that. I mean, because you're being pragmatic about it, but people waking up to realize it's not what they think. It's what those two entities and their representatives think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would invite you to be a part of the gambling wars like I was back in the, 2000s when, everybody thought Bob Riley was crazy for going and enforcing the law and shutting these places down. But that's exactly where you get, right? If you allow what was, illegal activity to happen back then, then you get to this point where they can just write, themselves into the law. Now, look, you go back to those days, I guess it was 2009, they had the Sweet Home Alabama plan. That entire bill, that entire proposal was meant to kind of grandfather them into the law because they knew they were outside of it. And so, but ever since then, there has been very little enforcement. So it's just a reality that this is not going anywhere, and they might as well regulate it, tax it, and shut down those who aren't complying.
Right. Before we run out of time here, too, and this is interesting, sets up a conversation I'm going to have next hour. You have five key takeaways from the February jobs report, and I think this is key as you talk about this. At the same time, we're talking about $1.9 trillion in. It, whatever we call that act, the thing that's got 9% COVID in it. What's the job scene looking like now?
Well, look, the February jobs report. Now, this is nationwide, not just Alabama, but it was great. I mean, the unemployment dropped slightly to 6.2. It's a lot better in Alabama. We'll see on Friday just how good. But adding almost 400,000 jobs, that's good. We need to be growing like that. I think any realist who looks at the situation with, 1.9 trillion about to go into the economy, you start worrying about inflation. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of cash on top of what's already out there, right? We've got a lot of cash floating around. And so, I think people are starting to worry about inflation. I'm in the middle of buying a house. I'm really ready to lock down this interest rate now before all this cash infusion causes inflation and interest rates to rise.
So, I mean, this is...
I am not a financial advisor. Please, nobody take my advice. I'm just saying that's what you worry about.
I think many of us are talking about the same thing and looking at this and just wondering, you've got to say, here's that February jobs report saying this at the same time we're putting You know, the kid's already hyper, and now we're giving some Lickamade sticks. You know what I'm saying? It's what do we think's going to happen?
Yeah, and I mean, look, if I was a member of Congress, if I was a senator, there's no way I could have supported that bill. There are going to be negative consequences. Inflation might be one of them. It's great to just fund everything you want to fund. It's great to just hand out goodies. And the Democrats have not been in power. They're calling in favors from the election and all that. I get it. I understand politics. But, you know, they just, you know, a year ago, you know, put, what was that, $1.2
trillion? Mm-hmm.
And now it's another $1.9. And you look at this economic report, we're actually improving. We're getting better. And so, you know, sending $350 billion to state and local governments, maybe some of them need it out there, but just looking around locally, maybe a little help, but...
But you need it because of what, right? I mean, that's always the thing. I mean, you could need it, but because of what? Just because you need it, the federal government's... if you can say, hey, this is COVID-related, that's one thing, but it sure be nice to have that, buddy.
See, I think they're in a situation, Sean, where, you know, they were going to pass a bill. They were going to do something. Pass a bill that says COVID relief, and everybody just kept on adding onto it like a Christmas tree, just putting on ornaments. And you can't say no to anybody because nobody was the adult in the room that just set a limit to say, we're not going to do more than, I don't know, $800 million, right, or $800 billion or a trillion, whatever it was. Nobody could be the adult to say, this is it. This is as much as we're going to do. So you just kept adding to it and adding to it, and it gets where it gets. It's really unhealthy. Just debt wise, and maybe it's going to be bad inflation wise. But look, when interest rates get raised and the economy starts to tighten up, everybody's going to know who to blame. And so I don't think it's surprising at all that Republicans voted completely against it.
There he is, Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com. And I hope to see you in Montgomery sometime soon. I got to be whenever they open things up.
Absolutely. Come on up, man.
All right, good deal. We'll talk soon.
See you.
All right, there he is. And we're coming right back. Oh, speaking of the COVID bill, I mentioned this morning, but prisoners getting stimulus checks. Not their families back at home. The prisoners also getting the stimulus check. We'll talk about that when we come back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:51, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here. All right, text coming in here. Well, okay, some of these texts about the prisoner thing. Let me roll the story out here, and then we'll get to the text here. This one caught my attention in a big way. So the story is that out of the, and not just this one, not just this $1.9 trillion, I have trouble calling it a COVID relief bill. Just like I said earlier, maybe my rock and roll rap analogy didn't work on many. Maybe somebody can find me a better analogy. It would be, this morning, because I said that would be like calling Blondie, beautiful Debbie Harry, she is still gorgeous, calling the band Blondie a rap band because they had Rapture, but even though everything else was a pretty new wave rock and roll, right? Okay, so, or if you called something, we would call it a fruit salad, but if you called it grape, you said that's grape. Well, yeah, there's grapes in there, but it's a fruit salad because there's a whole bunch of other stuff. There's actually more other stuff than there are grapes in there, right? So I have trouble with calling this the COVID relief bill because it's a, what, 9 to 10%? Let's say it's 10%. Easier math. 10% of this that's COVID related. But out of this, the idea that the prisoners get stimulus payments too. And this happened before. This happened in the two previous relief bills when President Trump was in office. This happened. Now, tried to block it, and a judge overturned it, but this is... And this is not just for family. Okay, here's an example. So over at Patch.com, they did a good job. They picked out somebody to say who gets a stimulus check. You know who gets a stimulus check? Tsarnaev, the Boston bomber. Remember? That's, I'm not going to say his name. Dirtbag. Dirtbag, the brother's bomber, gets a stimulus check. Gets a stimulus check. I mean, people said, well, you know, if stimulus checks could go to the families of people who are incarcerated, okay, fine. It could go to the family of an incarcerated person. But they're all getting them, the inmate. And if the job of the stimulus check is to help out people that are in the economy that had their lives impacted by the government shutdown surrounding COVID, the ward of the state, their life didn't change. And this is happening. How we let this, and there's a judge that moved in here. Okay, Dylan Roof. He's getting a check. I mean, we've lost our way here. So yeah, they tried to block it. I know twice, I guess, while Trump was in office, they tried to block this, and a judge said you can't. So those people will be getting stimulus checks as well. Your tax dollars, right? Your tax dollars that already are paying to keep those people incarcerated, keep them away from other human beings, are now going to also give them a stimulus check. What, they're going to spend it on the commissary, I guess, or something? It's unbelievable. We can't get out of our way. It seems like this is something that Democrats and Republicans could come together on and say, you know what? No, not this. We're not going to do this. If you're currently incarcerated, you don't get a check. If the family of somebody who's incarcerated, who's out there, the mom gets a check and the kids get fine. I mean, what is the point of the? I asked this during the first and second, actually not during the first, during the second, now the third, the build up to the third of these bills is, what is it supposed to represent? What is that $1,400 supposed to represent? They can't ever tell you that. You know, I ask, is that a week's pay? Why is it $1,400? Why isn't it $1,200? Why isn't it $1,600? Why isn't it $10 million? Why that number? What's it supposed to represent? And if it represents lost earning potential because all this, they're in prison. Their expenses are paid by we the people, and now their check is, and you're paying for both of them. Somebody do the math for me here. How many, there's like, I think 1 million people incarcerated. Let's just say it's 1 million, easier. 1 million people incarcerated. What is, and you give them, is that $1 billion? $1.14 billion, what's the math on that, math whizzes out there? If you have 1 million people incarcerated in the country, and they all get $1,400, is that $1.4 billion? Is that, is anybody helping me here? Let's see the text line. Here's the problem. I can't use the, I'm trying to use my brain. That part of my brain's lower down in the totem pole. But I think that's it. I think it's $1.4 billion. Unbelievable. On the text line, Chuck says, Sean, referencing the prisoners getting money, BS. I'll not use your term for the governor. Can Governor Ivey or the Alabama legislature make a law that all of the Alabama prisoners' money they receive goes to their victims? Chuck, I don't know that, but I don't think so. I mean, we're seeing how this is laid out. Sean on the text line says, do prisoners pay taxes? I don't know that. If they get their job there making license plates or something like that. David, the contraband cell phone in many prisons is fixing to become the iPhone 12. Right. Yeah, people asking, so what about your victims getting restitution? I don't know. I mean, this is, thank you, Sly. $1.4 billion. So $1.4 billion of this spending, this latest, let alone that it happened during Trump as well, and they tried to block it, and the judge said you can't block it. Maybe there's something real obvious that I'm missing here, but to me, this should be bipartisan, that people should say no. People should say no. Yeah, there's a quote here from Dick Durbin. Said Dick Durbin argued that prisoners' children could be affected by withholding the money from them. Let the children and the mother back at home, and I guess there could be mothers incarcerated too. Let this the parent back at home, they get one. They're not incarcerated. Their children aren't incarcerated. Not their fault. But what are we sending a stimulus check to Tsarnaev? It's disgusting.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile, streaming online, fmtalk1065.com. Things, I don't know what's back to normal, but one step at a time, right? All right, good deal. And I mentioned before we went to the news break there at the end of the hour, about an article I was reading over at Yellowhammer News, and a real treat to get the person who wrote it on the air with us to talk more about the stimulus and what it would have been like. You know, I always say, well, you know, well, what if we didn't do this? What if we hadn't done that? What if we could take the time machine and go back and replay the, you know, the last year without stimulus money? It's an interesting discussion. And we're joined by Dr. Daniel Sutter from Troy University, economics professor, and a lot to talk about here. Dr. Sutter, thanks for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm happy to join you.
Yeah, you write this story here. Headline, has Washington stimulus measures saved our economy? Well, I guess that's the question. I mean, what would it have been like if we hadn't poured all this money to it before and now another $1.9 trillion?
Well, trying to figure that out is really the essence of a problem that economists face. You know, that we always have to try to figure out what would have happened, you know, given what we chose not to do. And so this is a challenging issue for economists. We have to try and imagine what would have happened. And in this case, I mean, I think, you know, at one level, you can certainly see last spring in April, the unemployment rate had jumped up from 3.5% to over 14%. It had gone from the lowest in my lifetime to the highest in my lifetime in the span of 2 months. And GDP was projected to decline by as much as perhaps 50% if all of the shutdown policies remained in effect, you know, for at least until like the end of June. And so our economy largely recovered. By the end of the year, GDP was about back up to where it had been in the fourth quarter of 2019, and unemployment has come down to about 6% nationally in January. So at one level, you could say it seems like we avoided a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Right. We did. But what would, I mean, I know there's this is the impossible question, but what would have it looked like without that spending, or half that spending, or a quarter of that spending?
Right. Well, we can look at a few things that we've seen. And so one of the things we've seen is that personal savings have gone up a lot during the pandemic and the recovery. So not for all Americans, but for a number of Americans who are receiving the stimulus checks, it appears like they spent, you know, that they took a lot of that money to and have been saving it, or also paying down credit card debt, you know, which was, you know, has seen historic declines in Americans' credit card debt over the past year. So, on one hand, that's good for personal finances, but economists, to the extent that we think that government spending is going to be stimulating the economy, it should be leading to spending by households and businesses, not necessarily saving. And so this rise in personal savings suggests that, you know, the individual stimulus has done relatively little to stimulate the economy.
You're just joining us, talking to Daniel, Dr. Daniel Sutter, who's professor of economics with Troy University. But this is just kind of maybe the humanities discussion inside of economics, because I remember when the checks first came out, and exactly what you're saying is kind of, and I'm not saying I'm the only one who predicted it, but people were saving or holding on to it, because if the government's telling you something's bad enough, right, that that they're sending you this money, then a lot of people, prudent people, would say, well, then maybe I ought to, keep my powder dry here and keep the money I might need held back.
Definitely, because, you know, we didn't know how long the extreme shutdown policies would continue. We didn't know to what extent there might be ripple effects through the economy with some businesses closed, disruptions to supply chain. So, I mean, I think that was quite prudent. it was quite reasonable and prudent. And I certainly know that that's what I did a lot of, is try to save that money. But, you know, it also means that it wasn't going to stimulate the economy as much as at least some economists who believe that stimulus measures could work would have hoped.
I mean, this is, while we're talking about news of the day or news of the last year, Doctor, we're also talking about economic theories. And you go into talking mm-hmm. about macroeconomists and, those that follow the Keynesian idea versus, the Hayek or Mises. Kind of break this down of what you think this has shown, this experiment.
Well, I think it certainly suggests that, from a theoretical standpoint, the case for government spending as a stimulus for the economy has been, especially over the last 30 years or so, relatively weak. We know that a lot of the Keynesian macroeconomic models in the 1950s and 60s had a lot of problems with them. So we know that from a theoretical standpoint, the case for a stimulus has been pretty modest for a number of years. And then there's also the very real danger at this point in time, given that we started the pandemic with over $20 trillion in government debt, and much of this stimulus spending has been simply adding to the debt, that the debt impact of that is going to outweigh any kind of short-term benefit to the economy.
When does this show up? And I know I think it's showing up a little bit already. You look at staples and energy prices and all that, but when does it, this should bear inflationary fruit, shouldn't it? I mean, you put this much money in.
You would certainly think so. Although, to some extent, I think you could say that we're seeing some of the inflation in the form of delays in getting things ordered. So, things are, especially if you go and shop online, things aren't in stock as much as they used to be. A year ago, everything would be in stock. And so some of those things not being in stock, like I know somebody who is looking to purchase a Corvette, and like that production at the Corvette plant in Kentucky has been disrupted, and it'll be like months before they're going to be able to ship any Corvette. So you see like delays of this nature, and that's sort of in the way, it's sort of I think the inflation is showing up, because we could say, the available goods, we could like ration them and let the price rise for that. But retailers, the people producing these goods, aren't letting the price rise, but they're making us suffer delays. And that's, I think, where some of that inflation that we might otherwise expect to be seeing is showing up.
Okay, that's something I've never thought about. So an inflationary pressure that's not just the cost of a good. The inflationary pressure is because the retailer is capping themselves on raising that price. So the only way to make up the difference is to make it not cost more to produce, or, those factories are at half production, those kind of things. So time as a indicator of inflation, that's wild. I mean, it's taken a while to digest that. Very interesting.
Some children are walking by. There's the old line that when we, back in the 1980s, when people would compare the price of living in like Moscow versus New York and the Soviet Union, they'd say like, oh, the cost of living in the Soviet Union is very low compared to living in New York. But then the problem was that at those official prices, you couldn't buy anything. So
gotcha.
When we normally think about prices in the market, we think of the price is there and you can buy stuff if you want it.
But if you can't buy it, right, I got you. The price is this, but you can't, but there's none to buy at that price.
Yes. Yes.
All right. That's a big thing for me. I'm thinking about different places in the economy that's showing up. So what about this? So we've had these different stimulus, relief, whatever the terminology coming out of Washington is for COVID. Now we're here with what happened this weekend and what's getting ready to be signed off on in Washington. Another $1.9 trillion. But Dr. Sutter, at the same time, I'm looking at February jobs report. I'm looking at the housing sales, all this stuff. It seems like the cases of COVID coming down and states going back to not having a mask mandate. Where's this money going to go? Even though it's a pittance of the total bill, what is this going to do to the economy?
I can't imagine it's going to have that much of a stimulus effect, and it's certainly probably not needed now. The Congressional Budget Office and their recent forecast before, even not taking this into account, had put the thought that the economy would grow robustly even without a stimulus here. So, and the one part of this stimulus I think you could really say might have been valued was the relief to state governments, given the declines in revenue that they would have experienced in the last year. But the Biden stimulus was projecting about an 8% decline in revenues. But according to the Wall Street Journal, that the decline in revenue has only been about 1.6%. And so really, if the state's budgets were going to be in tatters because of declines in revenues and then forcing some kind of cuts in spending because states have to balance their budgets, then there might have been some rationale for some assistance to states simply keep them from cutting their budgets, which might impact things. But it seems like the budgetary impact at this point has been relatively modest in many states.
Yeah, in Alabama, one of those examples here, and thinking about, and I want to talk about unspent stimulus dollars. I mean, there was a while there when it was the December 31st deadline for spending that money from CARES Act 1 that, I mean, there was, there was some creative talk coming out of Montgomery on how they could apply that money. In other words, they didn't have the need for it. They were trying to find programs that could fit the definition, right? I mean, that wasn't just here. That was probably other states, too.
Exactly. Yeah, there was an estimated, I think, $1 trillion from last year that hadn't been spent at the end of 2020. Some Republicans have said, well, we didn't need another stimulus, so it should spend the money we've already appropriated. It's probably the case that it's more accurate to say that money's in the process of being spent, not that it's like completely available and just sitting in a bank account. But it does go back to the whole point of the stimulus, and the money that wasn't spent last year certainly didn't stimulate our economy in 2020. So at least a quarter, one third to a quarter of the stimulus dollars not being spent in 2020 certainly couldn't have stepped in and boosted our economy last year.
Yeah, if they didn't spend it, it didn't have the boost on the economy. So what we're fairly enough. So if you said the amount that if you're somebody who believes that the amount of government spending, you believe the government spending saved the economy, you have to back off that number some to say how much was spent by the time things started to turn around, even if you want to make the argument that it was successful.
Yeah. And, just another way of another perspective on this was, after the CARES Act passed and then the President Trump added like $500 billion to the payroll protection plan, we didn't get a stimulus passed in the fall. And some economists were projecting that without a stimulus in the fall, the economy was going to fall back again. You know, see an increase in unemployment and a decrease in GDP. And that didn't happen. We didn't have a fall stimulus, and we didn't see the economy fall back. So, again, there's another evidence that the economy recovered without a fall stimulus, even though many of the proponents of a stimulus said it would go in reverse.
What kind of – is there an addictive nature for governments or even for the economy in general to this kind of spending? In other words, are we just – if you believe that this is necessary to keep it going, eventually you can't keep doing this forever, right? I mean, eventually, let alone we have to start paying this back, which who knows who will do that. But what happens if you pull this out? I mean, if I'm up in Washington and I say, well, we're not going to pass this $1.9 trillion. What if it didn't pass? Do you, your prediction off what you're saying here, I don't know that we would have felt it, would we?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think it would have really hurt economic activity or somehow prevented the recovery from occurring. Politicians like to spend money, and so they would like to be able to reward the people who are asking them for money. They don't want to have to say no. And, you might think that eventually at some point we have to cut back spending to try to get our budget under control, but from a politician's standpoint, it never could be the right time to cut back spending. It'll always be like a good thing to do maybe at some point in the future, not now.
Yeah, I can imagine, we just have a minute left here, but I can imagine in the future, whatever situation faces our country, somebody's going to say, well, we did it back then, we need to do it for this thing too. It's almost like the new beachhead has been set.
Yes, it could be a very bad precedent, especially these multiple rounds of sending stimulus checks to households. Might be the kind of thing that we always think we need to do this again in the future.
All right. Before we wrap, so tell folks if they, Yellowhammer News is where I read your work, but is that where they go to find you on social media, read your work? Where should they look?
My column gets posted every week at the Yellowhammer. So that's the best place to go take a look at.
Dr. Daniel Sutter, thank you for your time. Thanks for being part of the show today.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to join you.
Hey, we'll do it again soon. Dr. Daniel Sutter, you know I love talking to economists. The audience knows that, Dr. Sutter. So I'll keep your number handy. He's a Charles Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel L. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University and the host of Econversations and Trojan Vision. And read his work over at yellowhammernews.com. But I'll tell you what, I'll put that piece up on my Twitter feed at FM Talk 1065. You can get it right there and we'll talk about it. All right, we come back. I had mentioned that my friend Bryant Knight, who is part of Team Fight or Die, right, the team that rows across the Atlantic Ocean to bring attention to veterans' issues, and he's doing it again this next year. His wife, who is his way better half, and make sure he heard that, is going to talk with us about a scholarship program that's available for veterans and people helping out veterans. We'll give you details on that when Lori Knight joins us coming up in just a couple minutes here at FM Talk 106.5, plus a conversation with one of my favorite physicians ever. Dr. Matthew Michaud is going to join us here at the end of the hour. It's all straight ahead. We'll go to news next, and then we're coming right back. More of Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. 135 FM Talk 106.5. This segment of the show brought to you by 1-800-GOT-JUNK, online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. A text earlier, somebody said, hey, I did what you said. Booked 1-800-GOT-JUNK to come to my place. Yeah, it's real easy. Online, 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com, or pick up the phone and call 1-800-GOT-JUNK. I like about the process is they realize you got stuff to do. You got a family, you got a job, you have things you're doing. So this whole thing where, what is it? They'll tell you, we'll be there sometime between 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. I mean, that's not how it works. 1-800-GOT-JUNK, they will actually find a day that works for you, window of time that works for you. They set an appointment, they come and see you, and they quote you a price on the job. And that could be at your house, could be a storage unit, could be at your business, anywhere you got junk. They'll quote you the price, you say yes, they get to work and get the junk gone. So check them out and check out how easy it is to get that appointment set. 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com, or just pick up the phone and call them at 1-800-GOT-JUNK. All right, I mentioned when we're going into the break, I'd be joined by the member of the Knight family that isn't on this show enough with me, even though I sure enjoy conversations with her husband, Bryant Knight. Lori Knight from Team Fight or Die is joining us now to talk more about the team and a scholarship that you may be eligible for. Lori, thanks for your time. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great, and I've got a lot of questions about this. The Caleb George Memorial Scholarships. Now, this is through Team Fight or Die, right?
That is correct, and we actually have 5 scholarships that we're going to give away, and each one is in the $2,000 amount. And they are, it's in 3 different categories. Should I talk about that now?
Talk about, so if somebody, y'all need to listen now, this is to see if you fit in the description here.
Well, and if you don't catch all of this, you can always go to our website as well, and we have a tab called Scholarships, and it explains everything out. So the first one is going to be awarded to a military or veteran or the immediate family member of such, as in a spouse or partner, a child, parent, or even grandchild of a veteran who is in a program studying to work with mental health for veterans and military and or military. And that person has to be pursuing at least a master's level of education. And this person needs to be attending a school that is accredited by, it's called KCREP, C-A-C-R-E-P or APA, accredited universities. And this person needs to be someone who has personally been touched by suicide, as Caleb George was a friend of ours and a son of a friend of the family's who took his life, and he was an active Army young man, and we wanted to make sure that someone else who's been touched by suicide, who's actually gone into the educational field and wants to work with veterans to help bring that staggering statistic down. And then the second one is for a University of Denver student. Anybody who's been following us knows that we are strategic partners with the University of Denver, and those students have worked with us. They've come to Mobile with us. They've come to the launch point in La Gomera. They've come to the end point in Antigua, and they've just been very helpful with our rowers and prepping them for some of the things that they meet up with on the ocean, like boredom and conflict management and stress management and those sorts of things. So this, the second scholarship goes to someone who is in that PsyD program, that doctoral program that they're holding there. And it is also for someone who is pursuing work with veterans post-graduation. And then the third one also is for a student enrolled in an accredited university through those same accreditations who is already working in research in the veteran mental health field. And it has to, that research needs to pertain to suicide prevention. As everyone knows, those numbers, it's kind of controversial whether the numbers are 20 a day or 22 a day, but all the statistics show that those numbers have gone up by 20% since COVID. And so we want to make sure that we are paying it forward and we are awarding students who are committed to working with finding an answer and trying to get those numbers whittled down a little bit. So the other day we were speaking with a company up in New York, West Hare Automotive Group, and we were talking with them about a future team. It's a 2023 team. And the company and the owner of the company, Scott Beeler, was so touched by the idea of us giving away scholarships that they threw in two more. One is from the man's personal account and the other is from that particular business account. And so we're awaiting what his, which one of these three scholarships he would like to duplicate, or if he just wants to leave it up to us. So either way, we have five $2,000 scholarships. Each of the scholarships you'll have to, if it's of a veteran or if you're in school, you just have to prove that you're in good standing, that you are a veteran or a family member of a veteran by showing either a dependent card. It could be any other, it could be an EB-214 or any other military record. For those, we will need for someone at the university to just affirm that the student is in good standings. And then once the student has been selected, we would simply ask for them to let us know how they use their money, as we know that there's a lot of uncovered costs that students run into when they are pursuing a master's and higher level of education. So our application is open this month only. It's March only. And so the deadline is March 31st. We have a committee of seven members who will review the applications, and we will do some interviews via phone and Zoom, and then we will vote on who gets it, and then we will announce that at the beginning of May, hopefully by Memorial Day.
This is a great program, but let me go back to the reasoning for this, and not just the scholarship, but team fight or die, and everything that goes behind this research, and that is that statistic. You said it. I know your husband has said it to me before as well, that those already grim statistics for our veterans taking their own lives, that during COVID, the isolation of COVID, Lori, that's increased. Mm-hmm. Do we know, there's individual situations, but the cause of that increase, mm-hmm. you think it is the separation from others, or?
Well, and that one is so multifaceted, Sean, that it's really difficult to pin it on any one thing. But just consider those people who are already struggling with depression and anxiety or suicidal thoughts, and then having been somewhat forced to be isolated, and then their support systems somewhat collapse because so many therapists weren't able to transition to an online sort of telehealth quickly enough. And to then just kind of compound that with people who actually struggle with substance use disorder and being, just kind of couples that all together and it's compounded. And then that has led to many more people making that permanent decision to a temporary problem.
Lori, how much of in the studying that goes in here, and these scholarships, you know, that help people that will be able to help our veterans, but how much of this, if you had to give me the, you know, the piece of the pie is this much or this much, is physical, the, you know, physical trauma, like we talk about TBI, and how much of it is having somebody to talk to and counseling? I mean, how much comes from one side, how much comes from the other?
Mm-hmm. And also difficult to put a broad answer to. But remember that with post-traumatic stress, whether it's actually a disorder or not, and traumatic brain injury, those two can be misdiagnosed. A lot of people believe that, well, I was never in a blast, so I couldn't have traumatic brain injury. But when, in fact, a lot of the training that military and veterans went through when they were in the military had to do with firing of weapons and larger weaponry like that, and that concussion falls under traumatic brain injury. And a lot of people see that as mild, but if we're talking about brain injury, like, is mild really a thing? Because it's right. The brain. And then alongside that is that trauma can be it stacks up on top of each event stacks up on top of it. And so someone who struggled with just, say, a very unsteady home life as a child, and then they were able to maybe hold it together through their teenage years, and then they decide to go into the military, that just some of the trauma that is witnessed can sort of trigger and bring up a lot of things that happen well before their actual time in military, which can then contribute to some of the struggles that happen, whether it shows up in substance use disorder or anxiety or depression or any of the other mental illness sort of flags, if you will.
If people are...
Say that it's either mental or physical, but the truth is trauma is stored in the body. And that when our nervous system gets hijacked, then oftentimes we can't... So if you're like, think about a time when you've been nervous about something, you feel that in your body, right? And so people who live in that perpetual state of nervousness and anxiety, it is definitely a physical thing. It's not just a mental thing. So teasing out the two of those are very difficult as well. And no matter what, even if you, like, if it's proven that it was a physical injury that has caused these things to happen, the truth is, if your amygdala, that little part of your brain that's shaped like an almond that has to do with your fight and flight center, if that is fired up, then there's absolutely no way that you can have a conversation with somebody about how you should be responding differently to something, because you can't think correctly. Your whole system is just out of whack. And so being able to get some of the tools that it takes to calm the system down, to then be able to address the issues that might be interfering with relationships or work or career path or anything else like that, is super important.
Lori, there's so much. We're going to have to get you back on the show soon to talk about this in depth. I do want to once again give you a chance to direct people where they go to look at the Caleb George Memorial Scholarships. Where online do they get the info?
Yeah, so our website is at usvetrow.org, and that's usvetrow.org. And we have a scholarships tab up there at the top. And it gives you all the three types of scholarship that we're giving away. And it gives you the directions about where to send the application. And if someone listening is in some way involved in some of the higher learning schools or maybe knows somebody, please pass this along, because we want this to go far and wide. And we want to be able to every year increase the numbers of scholarships given and increase the amounts. We realize that $2,000 isn't that much when it comes to higher education.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Thank you, Lori, for your work. We'll talk again soon.
Welcome back to Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. And a real treat to have the brain of Dr. Meshad and just an all-around great guy from Southern Cancer Center joining us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun, Sean.
It is fun, and there's so much that it's just fascinating what's happening with Southern Cancer Center. First of all, let's, I guess, back up for a second and talk about what y'all do with Southern Cancer Center. What that, you know, people hear your name here on the station. What do y'all do a day at Southern Cancer Center?
Well, you know, basically we treat patients who have malignancies or hematological disorders.
Okay.
And it's mostly probably 80-20 malignancy versus heme. But patients with cancer that we see them initially, we make recommendations. If it's surgery, we send them to a surgeon. If it's radiation, we send them to a radiation oncologist. Or if they need systemic therapy, we take care of them.
And we're going to get to that, too, the systemic
yes.
therapy. Fascinating. I guess let's go back and talk about, you know, y'all do tumor testing and precision medicine. So tumor testing is, I mean, is like just testing if it's malignant, or what does that mean?
Well, once you have an established diagnosis of a malignancy.
And that's
cancer,
tumors, right?
Well, tumor is a Latin word that just means swelling.
Okay.
And there are benign tumors and malignant tumors.
Okay.
And what we're talking about.
Y'all are interested in the malignant tumors.
Malignant yeah. tumors, and that's cancer.
Okay.
Okay. So when someone has cancer, you literally have to have a piece of tissue of some sort to confirm that it is cancer.
Okay.
And then you can take that tissue, analyze it further, and take it several levels down to figure out not only what it is and where it came from, but how the best way to treat it is.
So you got an ID, just because it's a tumor doesn't tell you what kind. I mean, you got an ID. Okay, number one, malignant. Number two, what kind of cancer, right?
Correct. So I think, you know, probably a simple example would be breast cancer.
Okay.
So a woman comes in with a lump in her breast. It's biopsied, and it's cancer.
Okay.
And there's several different types, but the most common one would be called infiltrating ductal cancer. And so then, from our standpoint, we want to know several things. What's the size of it? What's the grade of the tumor? How fast is it growing? What does it look like? What do the cells look like? Are they turning over rapidly? Or are they very indolent? Does it look like normal breast cancer? Normal breast tissue, or is it vastly different so that it's highly malignant? Once you've determined that, then you want to know, is it driven by estrogen, where you can treat it with estrogen-blocking drugs? Does it have a gene mutation like the HER2 new gene, so you can use targeted therapy? Is surgery alone all you need, or do you need surgery and radiation, and after surgery and radiation, which are local and regional treatments, do you need more like chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, targeted? There's all sorts.
And this information, when y'all do this biopsy, you get this, you're pulling this from that sample. All these questions.
This comes from the cancer itself.
You look at it and you go, all right, we've seen one of these before, and it means this, 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 and this.
Well, you get a profile of the malignancy, and then you can.
So that's the tumor profiling that y'all do.
Yes.
You talk about ways to deal with, and those of us that, you know, I don't know a person out there that doesn't have somebody in their family or friends that have had cancer, and you hear this, okay, they get a diagnosis of cancer. Now, people say chemotherapy. You talked about chemotherapy, but let's talk about it. You said surgery. You talk about radiation. You talk about systemic. So let's start first with surgery. I guess is that the...
So we'll start first with cancer.
Okay.
We have a person who has cancer in some organ.
You've taken the biopsy. We now know that they have cancer.
Okay. If it's a localized cancer, it can be removed surgically.
Is that like we hear with like skin cancer? Sometimes you're removing that piece or
yes.
Okay.
Well, what you're trying to do is remove the cancer with margins.
Yeah, I know y'all take out more than...
More, so that you're not being real close. You've got a good several, you know, millimeter or centimeter margins.
Okay.
And then you look at the regional lymph nodes. And nowadays, if you look, let's say there's a melanoma on the skin.
Okay.
They remove the melanoma, and you can see how deep it is or how aggressive it is. And then you can do what's called sentinel node biopsies, so that you inject the area of the cancer with a radioactive material that goes to the lymph nodes.
And that are connected to that area.
It'll go to the lymph node that the cancer's most likely to go to.
Because it's going to travel back through
the
that.
Same way the cancer goes. And if that lymph node is negative, the sentinel lymph node, then it hasn't spread. If the sentinel lymph node has malignant cells in it, then you know that the cancer has spread to the lymph nodes and you have to be more aggressive with your treatment. The real innovation of the sentinel lymph node concept, and it's changed the way we treat breast cancer and melanoma. In the old days, when a woman had a breast cancer, she would have a mastectomy or a lumpectomy, and then they would remove all the lymph nodes.
Right.
In the old days, they'd get 40, 50, 60 lymph nodes out. And
yeah, and you pointed on your arm. I remember this from family members that that's where they would go to get.
That's where the breast cancer would tend to go, is to the lymph nodes under the arm.
So like a secondary surgery to remove those.
Yes, and they would do this huge operation removing the lymph nodes, and it could be complicated because you've removed all these lymphatics, and the arm could swell.
Okay.
It's called lymphedema, and it could be very disabling. Well, now, with the sentinel lymph node technique, they know which one, two, or three lymph nodes to look at, the ones that take up.
It's the, precise,
the,
then.
So that you take that lymph node out, and instead of what they used to do, I mean, if you've got 60 lymph nodes, how are you going to look at them all? You cut them in half, and you look at them.
Yeah.
These lymph nodes, now that they're just dealing with one or two, they will do sections all through the lymph node. They will stain it. They'll do immunoperoxidase stains. They'll do all these special stains where they can find even two or three cancer cells, whereas before it had to be completely involved before you would see it.
Wow.
So now with sentinel node technology, we can find these cells that have gone to the lymph node, and what it means is that that cancer was shedding into the lymphatics and going to the lymph nodes. When it does that, it has access to the blood system and can go to distant organs. The problem is we can't see individual cells on x-rays mm-hmm. or CT scans or MRI scans, even a PET scan. You have to have a cancer that's probably a centimeter. Let's just say that for convenience.
Okay.
A 1 centimeter metastasis has 1 billion cancer cells in it.
Oh, my.
So what we're looking at now is lymph nodes that may have 100 cancer cells, and we can see that.
That you move that much further in, for the layman, zooming in. You're magnified how
because
you can see.
If you did x-ray studies, these lymph nodes would look normal. They would be normal on a PET scan. But when you actually remove the lymph node because it took up that contrast or
right.
that radioactivity, you can examine the entire lymph node, and literally you can find 10 cancer cells.
Wow. So this is so the process here, you were talking about the surgery, the specific surgery around that area, and then the connected lymph nodes in it. So if you then get that lymph node, if you take that lymph node out and it had those 100 cancer cells or whatever, can you then, is that, have you gotten it then, Dr. Michaud? I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like if you get the actual spot and then you get the connected lymph nodes and you get, did you get it at that spot? I mean, is that...
That's the problem, because the fact that it spread to the lymph node
okay.
means that it had access to the bloodstream.
Does that always equal it getting in there?
No, it doesn't, but the risk
right.
is much higher.
Right, so there's a chance.
So when someone has positive lymph nodes, we typically give them some kind of treatment that goes all over the body. That's systemic treatment.
All right, and I want to do that. We're going to come back on a future show and talk about systemic treatment. We're talking with Dr. Michaud from Southern Cancer Center. And people, listen to this. I mean, these are the folks that have done this before. You all have seen this before, and you can guide us in the right direction. So if somebody's, you know, gets a chance to, you know, come see y'all, it is kind of a total, even though you said you can send us here, send us there, It's a total cancer treatment. I mean, it's a total approach to cancer, which
it's called a multidisciplinary approach.
There you go. That's the actual word for it.
A medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, and a surgeon. And we all get together on almost every case and discuss. Each of us has our own part to play, and we try to put it together that gives the patient the best chance of cure.
This is fantastic. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.